Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, well, thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to Vic Adeliff, who helped to set up this function tonight. Our speaker is Khaled Abu Tomei, who's going to speak for us on Palestine and the future of the peace process. Our speaker will speak for about 20, 25 minutes or thereabouts. We'll then got plenty of time to have questions and discussion, but there are a lot of people here, and could we make sure your comments are brief? Okay, so our speaker is an Arab-Israeli journalist who works on the Jerusalem Post and reports news for the Jerusalem Post, also occasionally writes columns in the Jerusalem Post, and is also a producer consultant for NBC News. So you're very welcome, and the topic is Palestine and the future of the peace process. Khaled, thank you.
Thank you very much, and good evening to all of you. Thank you very much. Good evening to all of you, and thank you for this nice intro. I'd just like to start by telling you a bit more about my background and the work that I do before we talk about the more important issues out there, so that you could at least understand some of the things that I'm saying. As you heard correctly, my name is Khaled Abu Tomei, and I'm an Arab Muslim living in Jerusalem. I also happen to be an Israeli citizen. We're called there Israeli Arabs or Arab Israelis. And the reason I'm an Israeli citizen is because my father belongs to the Arab community inside Israel. We're talking about nearly 1.5 million Arabs. On the other hand, we're also called Palestinians because we see ourselves as part of the Palestinian people, and because in my case, my mom is a Palestinian from the West Bank. So if you are confused, like most of us are over there, you can just call me Israeli Arab Muslim Palestinian. And I've been working as a journalist for the past 29 years now, covering Palestinian affairs. It's basically all what happens in the West Bank and in Gaza. And my career as a journalist started by working for the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, many, many years ago, almost immediately after I finished high school, in fact. And because I always wanted to be a journalist, I walked into a PLO newspaper office in Jerusalem. You know, there were days when Israel allowed the PLO to have newspapers in Jerusalem, although the two sides did not recognize each other, but Israel turned a blind eye. So when I finished high school, I walked into one of these PLO newspaper offices, and they hired me first as a translator, then as a correspondent, and finally as an editor. I worked there for nearly 7 years, during which time I also went to Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And when I finished university, I had to make a decision. Do I go back and work for the PLO newspaper and do the same stuff that we were doing, or do I go out to become what I call a real journalist? And it took me about 7 seconds to make a decision. And I went out to work with the international media and later also with the Israeli media. Now, when I say work with international media, what does that mean? It means helping foreign journalists who come there and want to go to the West Bank and Gaza. You know, you can't just, as a foreign correspondent, wake up in the morning and drive into a Palestinian village or refugee camp on your own and say, good morning, I'm Rebecca from the Australian, I want to speak to Hamas, please. It doesn't work like that. A foreign correspondent who goes there is often accompanied by local people who help them. Why? Because they don't know the language, they don't know their way around, and most importantly, it could be not safe for someone to to venture into a village or refugee camp and start asking questions that are considered very suspicious. So the foreign media relies on people like me. We're called fixers, drivers, producers, translators, stringers, escort services, if you want, in the West Bank and Gaza. In the course of this work with international media, I became a writer myself on the Palestinians, writing in numerous newspapers around the world. New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and I also became a TV producer doing documentaries and other work on the Palestinians for a variety of networks around the world. Now, about 11 years ago, I was approached by another client, the Jerusalem Post. I assume you've all heard about this newspaper, or I hope you did. It's a daily Israeli newspaper. And they asked me if I could also join them and write for them on Palestinian affairs. Why? Because 11 years ago, in September 2000, the Second Intifada started, and the Second Uprising, and Israeli journalists stopped traveling to the West Bank and Gaza out of fear. And this fear was not unjustified, because it became very dangerous for Israelis in the West Bank and Gaza. So the Jerusalem Post came to me and said, Khaled, you're out there anyway. Apparently you know how to write in English. Why don't you also write for us on what's happening over there? And I did not hesitate, and I went to write for the Jerusalem Post, in addition to the work that I still do with the international media out there. So that's more or less what's keeping me busy, what I'm doing these days, and what I've been doing for the past 25 years almost. Now, you know, when I go out to speak, one of the first questions that people sometimes ask me is, you know, what kind of a story is this? Does it make sense? When I ask them why, they say, well, I mean, you started your career as a journalist working for the PLO, and then you end up writing in a Jewish paper? When did you become pro-Israel? Someone asked me the other day, and I'm like, excuse me, folks, I'm not pro-Israel, I'm not pro-Palestine, I'm not pro-America, and I'm not pro-Russia. But as a journalist, I'm pro the facts and the truth. And as a journalist, I have absolutely no problem working for any media outlet that is willing to provide me with a free platform. And I don't care if my editors are Jews, Christians, Muslims, or even from the Hare Krishna movement. And to be honest with you, I even find it sad and ironic that as an Arab Muslim living there, I have to go and work in a Jewish paper to be able to practice some form of real journalism. And why is that? Not because the Jerusalem Post pays me a salary that I'm saying this, but because we don't have a free media in the Palestinian areas, not to mention the rest of the Arab world. We didn't have a free media when I was working there in the 70s and in the 80s. We didn't get a free media when the PLO came there after the signing of the Oslo Accords, unfortunately. And we still don't have a free media under Fatah, Hamas, and the rest of the guys who are running the show out there. Now, someone else asked me, he said, okay, but, you know, aren't you seen as a traitor because you work for Israeli publications? I said, no. He asked me why. I said, because we Arabs don't boycott the Israeli media over there. There is no such thing as boycotting the Israeli media. I forgot to mention, but for a period of 14 years, I was also writing in Hebrew for a Hebrew newspaper. And among the people I used to interview were Yasser Arafat, the founder of Hamas, the leaders of Hamas, the most wanted Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. No one ever told me, we don't want to talk to you because you work for an Israeli publication. In that sense, the Palestinians are clever. Why? Because they know that if you want to relay a message to the Israeli public, the best way to do it is through the Israeli media. It's not 100% perfect. It's not the best media in the world. I have a lot of reservations about the Israeli media, but in that part of the world, in our neighborhood, if you compare the Israeli media to the Hamas media or the Fatah media or Bashar al-Assad's media, I'm sorry, the Israeli media is still much better. What to do? This is the reality over there. We have many good Palestinian journalists. We have many capable editors, professional people in the West Bank and Gaza, but you will not find them in the Palestinian media. They all go out to work in other publications. You will find them in Al Jazeera and with the foreign media. And you will also find them in the Israeli media. Almost every Israeli media organization has Arabs working for it over there. So this is, as I said, the reality that we live in. Now, the fact that we don't have a free media in Palestine is, in my view, one of the outcomes of the Oslo Accords. I'm one of those who have been arguing for many years that things have been going in the wrong direction in that part of the world ever since peace started. And we've even reached a point where many Jews and many Arabs living there would tell you, we miss the good old days before peace. Now, what am I talking about specifically? I'm referring to the Oslo Accords that were signed in 1993 between Israel and the PLO. The idea of the Oslo Accords is good. Two-state solution is nice. if you can ever implement it, by the way. Separation between Jews and Palestinians who don't want to live together, that's also good. There should be a divorce. There's a husband and a wife who can't get along together, but they live in the same house. You need to find a way to divide the house or share the house between them. They don't want to see each other. That's, in that case, in the Middle East, separation is a solution. If you're looking for peace and harmony and coexistence, forget about it. It should be complete disengagement between these two communities. It's too late now to talk about peace and coexistence and harmony and working together in the new Middle East, which Shimon Peres promised us. The ideas of the Oslo Accords were nice, and I even supported the Oslo Accords because I personally believe in the two-state solution, and I believe that the Palestinians are entitled to their own state alongside Israel, and I believe in Israel's right to exist, and all these wonderful ideas. My problem is not with the ideas of the Oslo Accords. My problem is with the way the Oslo Accords were implemented. Why? Because the Oslo Accords were based on the assumption in Israel and in the West that if you dump Yasser Arafat and the PLO in the West Bank and Gaza and you start pouring billions of dollars on them without holding them accountable, you will get peace. And so what if Yasser Arafat does not deliver? And so what if Yasser Arafat builds a casino instead of building a hospital? And so what if Yasser Arafat establishes 14 or 15 different security forces that are functioning more as militias? And so what if Yasser Arafat's wife gets $100,000 a month to do her shopping in Paris? You Arabs don't know anything about democracy and good government. That's what I was hearing back then from American and European diplomats when I was telling them, this is going to lead to an intifada, this will lead to violence, what you are doing, supporting a corrupt regime. It's not going to work. They said, what do you Arabs know about democracy and good government? You deserve another dictatorship. Look at all your Arab countries. So why are you guys different? I told them, you know what? The Palestinians living here are different. First of all, they're the most educated in the Arab world, the highest percentage in the Arab world. Secondly, the Palestinians do know something about good government and transparency and freedom of expression and democracy because, ironically, they picked it up from Israel. Yes, I'm not ashamed to say that we as Arabs living over there, we were also exposed to many good things inside Israel. Forget about the conflict, but in the good old days before peace, when it was one open country, any person in Gaza could wake up in the morning, get into his car, drive to any part of Israel and stay in Israel and work in Israel. And as such, we Arabs were also exposed to many good things inside Israel. Had you asked a majority of Palestinians back then, on the eve of the signing of the Oslo Accords, what type of government do you want here? The overwhelming majority of them would have told you, we want something that looks more like Israel than Bashar al-Assad or Saddam Hussein or any of these corrupt dictators over there. Why? Because, as I said, they tasted something of the Israeli experience, and we became even jealous of Israel. We wanted something like that. Unfortunately, the international community did not care what Palestinians wanted. The international community cared only what Yasser Arafat and several hundred people around him wanted. They brought Yasser Arafat over there in 1994, and the show began. He established the Palestinian National Authority, which was actually a one-man show called Yasser Arafat. Unfortunately, Yasser Arafat deprived his people of the international aid. And by doing so, he drove a majority of Palestinians into the open arms of Hamas. Why? Because many Palestinians woke up one morning and said, to hell with this peace process. We don't see the fruits of peace. Where is all the money going? How come it's only Yasser Arafat and several hundred people around him who are benefiting from this peace process? People got angry and bitter and frustrated. They lost faith in Yasser Arafat. They lost faith in the peace process. And they were driven into the open arms of Hamas. Hamas was sitting there telling the Palestinians, you see, folks, we told you from day one, there's no point in making peace. It's all about corruption. Yasser Arafat stole your money. There are other reasons, of course, why Palestinians lost faith in the peace process. I'm not exonerating Israel. I'm saying Israel also sent the wrong messages to the Palestinians by continuing with the policy of expanding existing settlements, by continuing with security measures. You see, what happened after Oslo, Israel helped bring the PLO to the West Bank and Gaza. In the West Bank and Gaza, we got anarchy and lawlessness, and everyone's carrying a gun. And then Israel said, oh my God, now I need to defend myself against my Palestinian neighbors. Why? Because there are mafias and gangs roaming the Palestinian street. Because Arafat is not in full control. And how do you defend yourself? By imposing restrictions on the movement of Palestinians, by confining them to their communities. So many Palestinians, after the peace process, woke up to discover that they can no longer go to Israel to work, they can no longer move around freely, they are subjected to severe restrictions, they need permits wherever they go. And all these actions sent the wrong message to the Palestinians about the peace process, that this is not real peace. We thought peace was going to be, you know, open borders, and we can go back to Tel Aviv and work. And that's another reason why Palestinians lost faith in the peace process. Hamas became so strong that when they one day challenged Yasser Arafat's people in a free and democratic election in 2006, they won. Hamas won because they were clever. They ran under the banner of change and reform. And what's been happening since then is very sad for the Palestinians, and the Palestinians are paying a very heavy price. The guys who lost the election, the Fatah people, the largest faction of the PLO, are saying, hey, Hamas, give it back. Who are you to take it from us? And Hamas saying, no way, I'm not stepping down. I want it in a free and democratic election. And if you don't believe me, ask Jimmy Carter, he supervised the elections. I can tell you as a journalist who covered those elections, of course it was a free and democratic election, because if you think of it, otherwise Hamas would not have won it. And if anyone is to blame for Hamas's rise to power, it's the Americans, who first demanded a free and democratic election from the Palestinians, and secondly, allowed Hamas to participate in that election unconditionally, ignoring warnings from Israel and from the PLO against allowing Hamas to participate in an election unconditionally. You know, 10 years before that, in 1996, Hamas boycotted the same election under the pretext that anyone who participates in these elections is an infidel, is a traitor, because these elections are held under the umbrella of Oslo, which means two-state solution, and we don't accept the two-state solution. 10 years later, Hamas participated in the same process, and no one came to Hamas and said, this is double talk, you hypocrites. No, they took advantage of the same Oslo Accords that they don't recognize to come to power. And that was a mistake. The Americans should have back then said, Hamas, this is wonderful that you have decided to run an election. We welcome it, but excuse me, there are three conditions. You have to recognize the peace process because you're running an election under the peace process. Secondly, you have to renounce violence. And thirdly, you have to recognize Israel's right to exist if you want to be part of a political process. You can't have it both ways. But the Americans, you know what? They did demand it when the day after Hamas won the election. They discovered the day after Hamas won the election that Hamas is a terrorist organization. The PLO's refusal to accept their defeat and Hamas's insistence on clinging to power triggered a power struggle that has so far claimed the lives of nearly 2,000 Palestinians, and thousands of others have been injured. And this power struggle between the guys who won the election and the guys who lost the election, this power struggle reached its peak in 2007 when Hamas woke up one morning and kicked all the PLO people out of Gaza. And I was down there, and I saw it. In less than a week, less than 10,000 Hamas men defeated more than 40,000 U.S.-trained, European-trained, and funded Palestinian policemen in Gaza. How did that happen? Very simple. They did not fight the PLO. As soon as Hamas started shooting, they surrendered and ran away. First, they ran towards Egypt. Why? Because for those who don't know, and I've discovered that many people in North America don't know, Gaza also has a joint border with Egypt. And what did Hosni Mubarak do? He sealed the border, sending these people to knock on Israel's door for help. And Israel did come to the rescue and took the PLO people and dumped them in the West Bank, and that was the end of the game. So if you look at the reality on the ground in the last 4 years with the Palestinian situation, you will see that divisions, power struggle. You know, I said before that I'm one of those who support the two-state solution. Now, if you think of it, in the end, we did get a two-state solution over there. The Palestinians ended up with two states. one down there in Gaza, and one over there. And sorry, I keep imagining that I'm standing in Jerusalem when I say there. One in Gaza and one in the West Bank. Now, the one in Gaza is this radical Islamic entity that is run by Hamas and funded by Iran, Syria, Islamic Jihad, Muslim Brotherhood, Hezbollah, Nasrallah, I don't know, all these Allahs. And it's a frightening situation. And I can tell you as a Muslim, no thank you, I don't want to live there. I'd rather stay with Israel, to be honest with you. It's much safer. So that's what we have down there in Gaza. In the middle we have Israel, and in the West Bank we also have Israel. And we have the PLO people, the Palestinian Authority, who are in power largely thanks to the presence of the Israel Defense Forces in the West Bank. If Israel carries out what the PLO is demanding, which is a withdrawal to the 1967 lines, the PLO will collapse and Hamas will take over the West Bank. It's very clear, and the PLO, they're not stupid, they know it, the Palestinian Authority, that they are, why? You would ask yourself, but why? You know, why is Hamas still so popular? Hamas is still so popular because of the international sanctions against Hamas that have rallied many Palestinians against behind Hamas, and that have earned Hamas a lot of sympathy. The attitude on the Palestinian street is, oh, these poor Hamas people, they want it in a free and democratic election. And ever since they came to power, no one's giving them a chance. The whole world is against them. America, Israel, Europe, the Arab countries, and even the PLO. And Hamas did not fail in power, they would tell you. Why? Because no one gave them a chance. They're not corrupt because they don't have money. So people don't hold Hamas responsible for failure. Secondly, Hamas is popular because the PLO has failed to reform in the aftermath of its defeat to Hamas in the election that took place in 2006, and that was all about internal issues such as financial corruption and good government. Since they lost the election, the PLO hasn't removed one person from its list. It's the same guys running the show, pretending as if nothing happened. You know, so what? We lost an election because we're corrupt. The people don't trust us. We've lost our credibility. But so what? Condoleezza Rice told us to stay in power, so we'll just stay in power in the West Bank. And we'll continue with all the chutzpah in the world to run the show as if nothing happened. Now, the Palestinians are not stupid. If you hold a free and democratic election tomorrow morning, the Palestinians are not going to vote for the same guys they voted out 4 years ago or 5 years ago if these guys have not changed and have not reformed. And it's the same faces. You can't fool the Palestinians. And that's why it will be again a vote of protest if Hamas runs in the election, and Hamas will take it. It will be a vote of protest against the PLO. Add to this the fact that the PLO in the West Bank is today seen by many Palestinians as puppets in the hands of Israel, America, Europe, as traitors, CIA agents. You know, you hear all these things. And may God help them, by the way. They are in a very difficult situation, the PLO. They have Israel to worry about. They have the Arab world that does not care about them. They have Hamas on their backs. They even have internal problems. So, you know, it's not easy. And they have the Palestinians also barking at them in many ways, and demanding too many things from them that they can't deliver. Now, the question we need to ask ourselves is, so how do we move forward with the peace process? And the answer is very simple. You cannot move forward with any peace process when the Palestinians are divided, and they're not speaking in one voice, and they're even fighting each other, and there's anarchy, there's lawlessness. Where are you going to establish a Palestinian state? In the West Bank or in Gaza? The Palestinians are today divided into two camps. One is the radical camp led by Hamas. And that camp could be, by the way, almost half of the Palestinians. And what is that camp saying? I want 100% of everything. All of Israel is mine. It's all Muslim-owned land. I want to dismantle the Jewish state and replace it with an Islamic state. And if there are some Jews who would like to live as a minority under my regime, they are welcome. Otherwise, all of you get out of here. That's a radical camp. And they're saying, we don't want to recognize Israel. We don't want to negotiate with Israel. Forget it. And by the way, I even give them credit for being very honest and straight about their message and consistent. and for delivering it in the same language. You know, the message does not differ from one language to another. And someone who happens to speak more than one language, I can tell you that their message is very clear. As I said, it's what I spelled, what I told you. The other camp, in the West, they call them the moderate camp, the PLO people. I call them the less radical camp. Their position is, I want 100% of 1967. And I cannot make a 1% concession on that. Give me everything you took in 1967. I've already made a concession, they would tell you, by recognizing Israel's right to exist on 78% of mandatory Palestine. So, now you have to give me everything of 67. That's fine. Now, under the current circumstances, even if Israel wanted to go back exactly to the 1967 borders, it's almost impossible because of all the new facts that have been created on the ground. The 1967 lines are not even borders. They don't exist. If you ask me now, as someone who travels in the West Bank almost every day, to show you exactly where the 1967 lines, I would have to take you to people's bedrooms and kitchens and backyards and garages. Why? Because in the meantime, over the past 44 years, both Jews and Arabs have built on these lines. And they don't, you know, exist. By the way, going back exactly to the 1967 lines would mean destroying hundreds, if not thousands, of Palestinian and Jewish homes. So Israel, even if it wanted, it can't go exactly back to the 1967 lines. Now the PLO, they're not stupid. They know that Israel is not going to give them 100%. So they are in trouble. Why? Because they have been telling the Palestinians, anyone who makes a 1% concession to Israel is a traitor. The right of return is sacred. Jerusalem, it's all ours. Now, I can understand the PLO when they say we don't want to go back to the negotiations with Israel. Why? Because if you go back to negotiate with Israel, you might be asked to make some kind of a compromise. And if your demands are 100% or nothing, then you are right and you just sit at home and you say, give it to me, bring it to me. The PLO has decided to do something else. They've decided that instead of negotiating with Israel, we'll go and negotiate with the international community about a Palestinian state. We will try to internationalize the conflict to impose a solution on Israel. We will try to get from the UN what Israel is not giving us at the negotiating table. That is exactly their strategy right now. That there's no point in going back to the negotiations with Israel because Israel's not going to give us 100%. And even if Israel offered today 92% or 95%, that's still not enough because according to Israel, Ehud Olmert already offered 97% or 98%, and before that, Ehud Barak offered. Yasser Arafat had the same problem at Camp David. Yasser Arafat went to Camp David. He was offered what he was offered. I don't know exactly. The Israelis say 97%. It was Palestinian officials admitted, at least to me and in the media, that it was a generous offer. There was something good on the table. When we asked Arafat after he came back to Ramallah, what happened? Why didn't you take the offer? He said, they didn't offer me 100%. How can I take it? I don't want to go down into history as a traitor. I don't want to end up drinking coffee with Anwar Sadat up there. Now, why is that? Because yes, Arafat also had been telling the Palestinians that there will be no concessions. You see, you radicalize Palestinian society, and then when you go to negotiate with Israel, you're afraid to make any concessions. The truth is that today there is no Palestinian leader who has a mandate to make any concessions to Israel. Whether it's Hamas, Fatah, the most moderate person does not have a mandate. Now, I want to ask Mahmoud Abbas the following question, the Palestinian president. Do you, sir, have a mandate to go to the UN in September and ask for a Palestinian state? Did you win the consensus of the Palestinians? How are you going to go to New York in September and ask for a Palestinian state when you can't even visit your private house in Gaza, which has been occupied by Hamas? How can you go to the UN in September without talking or seeking the advice or consulting with other Palestinians? Listen very carefully to what Hamas is saying. Hamas is saying this is a scam. It's a PR stunt on the part of Mahmoud Abbas. We don't accept it. We won't recognize it. They're opposed to it, not because they're opposed to a Palestinian state. They're opposed to it because they say, what do you mean? You're asking for a state only on 67. What about 48? It's all ours. There are others who are also opposed to it. The Palestinian refugees. Did Mahmoud Abbas consult with the refugees abroad? They're also strongly opposed to it because they're saying, hey, what about our case? You're going to the UN to ask for a state, but you're not demanding the right of return. We have a right of return to Israel. So they're also opposed to it. The Palestinian Prime Minister is opposed to it for other reasons, because he's afraid that it will drag or it will result in American and European sanctions against the Palestinian Authority, and the Palestinian Authority will go bankrupt. And he's saying, why should we risk our relations now? The timing is bad, he's saying. Other Fatah officials are opposed to it, but when you don't have a democracy in Ramallah, and you don't have elections, and you don't have a parliament that is functioning, and you don't have a free media, the result is that five people are sitting in Ramallah deciding, making fateful decisions, historic decisions, on behalf of all Palestinians without consulting with anyone. Who gave you the right to go and damage relations between Palestinians in America that is threatening now to use the veto and to cut off financial aid? What about, you know, agreement among the Palestinians? This will only deepen divisions among the Palestinians, what he is planning. Add to this the fact that it will also play into Israel's hands. It will play into the hands of those who don't want a Palestinian state and who don't want the peace process to continue. Why? Because if you listen very carefully to what Avigdor Lieberman is saying, the foreign minister, he's saying what the Palestinian Authority is planning to do is a unilateral move. And the Oslo Accord specifically banned both sides from doing unilateral moves. So if you do it, Mahmoud Abbas, that means the end of the peace process. It means the end of the Oslo Accords. And that means that I, Israel, also have the right to reciprocate with unilateral measures. And these unilateral measures will be, as we all know by now, annexing parts of the West Bank that Israel is interested in. And that is very bad for the peace process. It will plunge the area into chaos and anarchy and I don't know what. The only way to achieve a Palestinian state over there, and there should be a Palestinian state, is by negotiating with Israel, whether you like Israel or not. Why? Because you have to discuss so many details with Israel. In the West Bank, there are 200,000 Jews. And Jews and Arabs in the West Bank share water, electricity, highways, a lot of things that, you know, the UN will give you a piece of paper at the end of the day. But if you want to work out the specific details of a Palestinian state, you have to sit with Israel. So it would be much better for Mahmoud Abbas if he didn't fall into this trap that he's going to. The feeling in Ramallah, by the way, is that he has climbed a very high tree. And now he's searching for a way to come down. And he wants to come down, but he wants to come down in an honorable way. And he's demanding two things right now. He's saying, okay, a full freeze of settlement construction. And I want a commitment that when the negotiations restart, they would be based on the 1967 lines. In the meantime, he's not getting it. Well, he did get a settlement freeze about a year and a half ago for 10 months. He did not seize the opportunity. Why? Because the truth is that the Palestinian government does not trust Netanyahu. And they're not convinced that Netanyahu will help them with the Palestinian state. There's a problem. But then I ask myself the following question. As someone who's been following, you know, the Palestinian Authority's actions almost every day, I say, okay, Netanyahu is a problem. I agree with you. And he's a bad man. You know, Ehud Olmert was in power. And Tzipi Livni was the foreign minister. I didn't see, you know, you make any progress. Shimon Peres was once prime minister in Israel. I didn't see the peace process move. Ehud Barak was a prime minister. So when we have labor in power, they complain that this is bad and the peace process is not moving. Then we get Likud in power, and they say, well, how can the peace process move forward? Because we have Likud now in power. The Palestinian Authority, the truth is, I'm not sure they know what they want. And there is no clear strategy. They are rushing towards this UN, they've turned the whole issue of statehood into the major issue of the Palestinian cause of the Israeli-Arab conflict, as if there is nothing else to worry about, when they don't have a clear mandate to do it. It would be much better if they held elections first, held the referendum, got their act together. A state is not something that Ban Ki-moon or Tzipi Livni or Mr. Barack Obama should give you. A state is something that you work very hard to achieve. You establish proper institutions, you reunite yourselves, you earn the respect of the international community, you dismantle militias and gangs, you bring reform and democracy, you allow a free media in Palestine, you allow an open debate, and then the whole world will come to you and say, wow, you guys have really built something very nice over here. You know what? We want to impose a state on you. But if you're going to sit at home and wait until someone brings you a state on silver platter, that's not going to happen. And bidding on Ban Ki-moon and Germany, and this is not the way to achieve statehood. Go back to the negotiating table, talk to Israel. Don't tell me the settlements. You know what? There's also some hypocrisy with the issue of settlements. Did the Palestinian Authority discover the settlements just now? Why didn't you demand a settlement freeze when you signed the Oslo Accords? I asked the PLO. They said, oh, we forgot. Yasser Arafat was negotiating with Israel for 17 or 16 years while the settlements were growing and expanding day by day. Arafat did not turn it into an issue. Mahmoud Abbas, by the way, every morning when he wakes up and he opens the window of his eastern room, bedroom, he sees a settlement in front of him. Bet El in Ramallah. So what happened, Mahmoud Abbas? You just discovered that the settlements are a problem. I'll tell you what happened. President Obama turned it into an issue. About 2 years ago, President Obama woke up one morning and demanded something that the Palestinian Authority had not even demanded, which was a full cessation of settlement construction. Palestinian leaders woke up in the morning to discover that Obama was being more Palestinian than the Palestinians. So they said, oh my God, now we also have to demand it. They started demanding a full freeze of settlement construction. A few months later, they woke up in the morning to discover that Obama came down the tree, leaving them still up there demanding it. And now, they're putting all the blame on Obama. You got us into this, you solve it. We don't know what to do. So these are, you know, the major issues we're talking about. These are the real challenges facing the Palestinians. It's not very easy. Even if you want to go and negotiate with Israel, you need to get your act together. Israel would not respect you if you are divided and killing each other and imprisoning each other and violating the human rights of each other and establishing special prisons for each other. Some bad things are happening. There's a war going on between the two Palestinian states. So you have to be united, strong, proper institutions, good government, and then you go and sit with Israel and negotiate, and then you go to the UN and ask for a state. Under the current circumstances, all you are going to get from the UN is a declaration, a piece of paper. And so what? Israel's still there, sitting on the ground. Nothing will change. We're also, the biggest threat also, is that we could lose the support of the Israeli public. Why? Because the Israeli public, a majority of them, supports the two-state solution. But when the Israeli public sees that the Palestinian Authority is trying to impose a solution on Israel and rallying the world against Israel, the Israeli public is going to be pushed to the corner. And the Israeli public will start saying, what do these Palestinians want from us? So don't push the Israelis to the corner. Go back, put Netanyahu to test. Tell Netanyahu, you know what? 3 more months of negotiations, let's see. But don't do anything unilaterally because you will fall into a trap. That's what I'm saying. And that's what many Palestinians, by the way, are saying. But you don't hear their voices, by the way. I don't know why. You need to ask your media also. So on this unhappy note...
That's right. Thank you.
If anyone has any questions...
So we've got till no later than 7 o'clock. So we've got plenty of time. We've got 20 minutes or thereabouts. So have a drink of water. Now a lot of people here, so you've got to be brief with your question or your comment. Just to start off, you said that Mr. Abbas will be going to the United Nations in September without a clear mandate from his own people. You're no doubt you're aware of, in the West there are a number of people who say they're talking on behalf of Palestinians who, not Palestinians, but people who say they're talking on behalf of Palestinians who advocate a boycott of Israel. What would be the response of, say, the 20% of Israelis who are Arabs to a boycott? Would that be different to the 80% of Israelis who are not Arabs? What's the feeling in Israel about the boycott campaign? Just come back and talk into the microphone.
Is it an anti-Israel boycott campaign? Or
the anti-Israel boycott
campaign. Let me tell you my personal view. I might represent the mainstream among Israeli Arabs. I don't believe in negative action, to be honest with you. And if boycotts bring peace and harmony and coexistence, I'll be the first person to support it. But I don't see anything positive coming out of it. And sometimes I ask myself, is it about hating Israel or is it about helping the Palestinians? If it's about hating Israel, then, you know, that's a different agenda. If you want to help, please get involved in positive things. Boycotts, conflicts, we're fed up with all these things. Instead of organizing boycotts, for example, let's invite Palestinians and Jews to Australia to talk about peace. Do something moderate. But boycotts don't really help. I don't see how it's helping. It's also pushing Jews into the corner, by the way. It's alienating them. And I don't see them, you know, succumbing to pressure and saying, oh my God, you know, now we can't sell Tnuva, and what do we do with Dead Sea products? It's not changing anything other than escalating tensions and pushing Jews to the corner. This does not help. So my advice always is, you know, I like to see positive things instead of boycotts and all these things that people talk about.
How do you see, if you've got a crystal ball, how do you see the things panning out over, say, the next 10 years?
The question is, how do you see things panning out over the next 10 years if you had a crystal ball?
You know what? To be honest with you, I'm very careful when it comes to predicting things, because we live in the Middle East, and in the Middle East, you can go to sleep with one reality and wake up in the morning with a completely different reality. I don't even know what's going to happen in 10 minutes from now, to be honest with you. But I'm very worried. I'm very worried about many things. I look at the land over there and I see a very small piece of land. From the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, we're talking about 5 million Arabs and 5 million Jews almost. We're almost equal if you include the Israeli Arabs. And the land is getting smaller and we all live on top of each other and next to each other and across the street from each other. I'm worried that if there isn't separation now in the form of two states or two entities, that we will just end up, you know, in the form of a one-state solution, which both sides don't want, by the way. I hear more about the one-state solution in Europe and in Australia than I do over there. A majority of Jews don't want the one-state solution because they're afraid about the future, the Jewish identity of the state. A majority of Palestinians are not fighting to become Israeli citizens. They're fighting for separation. They're fighting for independence from Israel. They're not fighting to become Israeli citizens and vote for the Knesset. So there needs to be progress. If there isn't any progress, my concern is that the radicals will take over the Islamic world and the Arab world. And that will be much more difficult. There are still some moderate Arabs out there. So don't lose them, that's what I say. Try to revive the peace process. Try to do something positive for now before it's too late.
Okay, so there's questions around here. We've got plenty of time. Yeah, one
after, yeah. Do you see any future for the refugees who are the descendants of the ones that were, of course...
Look, you know, the issue... I'm one of those who argue, by the way, that if you solve the issue of the refugees, you've solved maybe 85% or 90% of the Israeli-Arab conflict. Now, this is a tragedy, and I feel sympathy for anyone who loses his house or his property, whether he's a Jew or an Arab, by the way. I don't distinguish. Anyone who is a victim of a war and lost his property is a refugee, and, in my view, is entitled to compensation and other things. Now, what we need on the Arab side is a brave Arab leader who will stand up and go to the refugees and tell them, listen, folks, we're not going to lie to you anymore. What to do? You know, the Jews don't want you back over there. Yes, you have rights. Yes, you have lands. But there is a historic compromise. Yes, we acknowledge that, you know, you have a tragedy. Yes, yes, yes. But there has to be some kind of compromise. So there are three ways to solve your problem. One is financial compensation. Number two, resettlement in the Arab world. Maybe Australia will take 100,000, I don't know. Canada. And number three, Palestinians would be allowed to come back to the future Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. These are the three realistic solutions. Look, it would be nice, of course, if Israel opened the gates and millions of people came back. But show me one Jew, the most left-wing Jew in Israel, who would accept it. We have to be realistic. No Jew will accept it. The last thing, you know what? Many Jews they already see us Israeli Arabs as too much. So they're not going to bring in another 3 or 4 million Arabs into Israel. They want to preserve the Jewish identity of the state. They're saying, we're headed toward the two-state solution. Arabs here and Jews here. This is what they want. So I'm realistic. I'm not saying, they don't have any rights. Yes, they have rights. But compensation is a solution. Resettlement is a solution. And going back to the future Palestinian state is a solution. But what the Arab world is doing in the meantime is committing a crime and a lot of injustice towards these poor people living in the refugee camps. We're holding them there for the past 65 years, telling them, only if you wait another 200 years, you'll go back. And in the meantime, we're creating new generations of refugees, more frustration, more bitterness. The first intifada erupted in the refugee camps. They started it. Someone like me is not going to start an intifada living in Jerusalem. And the middle class in Ramallah did not start the intifada. And wealthy people in Nablus and Hebron did not start the intifada. It's usually in these areas. The second intifada also started in the refugee camps. So we have to be very careful. If you solve that issue, you've solved a lot of the problem. But show me one Palestinian leader or one Arab leader who has the guts to stand up and say it. I don't understand why no one wants to say it.
Okay, so we go here and we go there, but very briefly. Yeah.
I'm just wondering why you don't go into politics.
The question is, our speaker should go into politics.
May God forbid, I feel that I have much more influence and much more impact by being a little Arab reporter in the field. That's what I call myself. By being someone with no agenda and someone who just tells the story as it is, I've met with President Obama, I've met with Clinton, I'm invited to meet presidents and prime ministers and foreign ministers and universities and think tanks. So this is the power of just being someone with no agenda. And I'm not a diplomat, I'm not a politician. I can speak freely because I have nothing to lose.
There's a question here, then we go over here. Yeah.
Hi, I know you've already mentioned the threat of radical Islam, but the issue is that I just feel that their moderate Arab voice is not loud enough at the moment. And even amongst my Palestinian friends, they don't seem to speak loud, and I'm wondering if you do at times feel threatened, and people that do speak out, and you're looking at the difference in Gaza now, and there's no freedom for moderate people to speak out there at all.
You're right.
Maybe you could just briefly repeat the question for the background.
Yeah, where are the moderate Arabs and moderate Muslims? Why aren't they speaking out against radical Islam?
Yeah, the Persians regret it from Iran now. They say it's too late.
I wrote an article entitled Where are the Moderate Arabs and Where are the Moderate Muslims? Now, I can understand why Arabs living and Muslims living in the Middle East are afraid. And if you're living in Gaza, I can understand why you're afraid. I cannot understand why moderate Arabs and moderate Muslims living in Australia and Canada and the US are not speaking out. Islam has been hijacked by a dominant minority of thugs and murderers. And if we don't wake up, we will all be slaughtered. These murderers and thugs who have hijacked Islam, they will kill me, the moderate Muslim, on their way to killing the Jews and the Christians and the Crusaders and the infidels and all the enemies. Why? Because they see me as a fifth column, as an obstacle. And if I don't speak out today, I'm in trouble. But as you said, you're right. They're not speaking out. They will pay the price. They're sitting on the fence, watching. Here and there you do hear voices. But they need to speak out very quickly. And the international community needs to go to them and say, start speaking out before it's too late. We're losing Egypt, by the way, to radical Islam. And soon we'll lose Jordan. Remember my words. And we've lost Lebanon to Hezbollah and Iran. And Iran is very involved. And soon the Muslim Brotherhood will take over Syria. And then what's the future? You know what? Sometimes, to be honest with you, as a Muslim, when I wake up and I see what's happening around me in the Arab world and in the Muslim world, every morning, I say how lucky I am that I live in the Jewish state. Really?
So why do you go and see our grand senators here and stop asking them to support the left?
Look, it's not...
The suggestion is, why don't you go and tell this to the green senators here?
It's not about being pro-Israel. I'm not a Zionist, and I'm not going to sing Hatikva. But at the end of the day, when I wake up as a citizen of Israel, and I see democracy and freedom of movement, and I can speak out and all these things, and I see that my Arab brothers are denied these things and are being slaughtered by Arabs in the Arab world, that's why I say these things. Every second or third person I meet in Ramallah, his or her dream is to become Israeli citizens. I know what I'm talking about, and I can bring you the people. Now again, not because they have studied the teachings of Jabotinsky and Herzl, and they believe in the Jewish state, and they want to sing Hatikva. No, they want a better life. People are not stupid. I have family in Jordan. Their dream is to move to Israel. I have friends in Egypt who ask me if I know someone in Israel they can bribe to get an Israeli citizenship. Now, this is a stain of shame on the Arab governments that are treating the Arab people like that. That we have, at the end of the day, to run to Israel.
Knowing your reluctance to speculate about the future, can I ask you for an analysis of the past? Is the present situation any improvement of that existing at the time of the Khartoum Conference?
What year is that?
The Khartoum Conference.
67.
With the three notes.
The three notes. I'm asking you, has any progress...
So has anything got better since 67 is the question, right? Okay.
Look, in 67, the Arab summit came out with three notes. No to recognizing Israel, no to peace with Israel. I can't remember the exact notes, but...
No negotiations.
No negotiations and all that. When I look at the Arab world today, I'm talking about the Arab masses and the Arab people and the Muslim people. I'm not talking about the governments. Forget, the governments don't represent the Arab people. To be honest with you, I'm going to say something very powerful. I believe that there's still a majority of people in the Arab and Muslim world that has not come to terms with Israel's right to exist. They still don't. They still see Israel as an alien body, a cancer, a state that was imposed on Arabs and should not be there. That is the... Unfortunately, that's a message that we are also sending to the younger generations. There are billions of people out there who are walking with this perception that Europe wanted to get rid of the Jews after World War II. So they rewarded them by stealing the land from the Arabs and creating the state of Israel and kicked out all the Arabs. And these Jews have no historical rights, no religious rights, no attachment to the land. And this is what many people will tell you. You know what? Even moderate people tell me these things. And they say these things if you listen to what they say in Arabic. Forget what they say in English.
There's a question down here. Yeah, go on.
What is the negotiated position, if there is one, about Jerusalem between the Arabs?
I mean, if you ask the Palestinian Authority, they say we want all of East Jerusalem. And as someone who lives in Jerusalem, and who knows Jerusalem very well, I can tell you today, because of all the new facts on the ground, Jerusalem cannot be physically divided. Finito. Israel won the battle over Jerusalem. Israel managed, since 1967, to create a Jewish majority in Jerusalem, in East Jerusalem. Because you cannot redivide Jerusalem, and it's impossible, and Jerusalem is a very small city, and it would lead to many problems, all you can think about is sharing Jerusalem, if you want. And there are ideas floating around. For example, Muslims should have full access to the holy sites, Jews should have full access to their holy sites, Arabs should rule Arabs in Jerusalem, and Jews should rule Jerusalem. There's no reason why a Jewish garbage collector should come to an Arab village in Jerusalem and collect garbage, for example. Now, this can be solved through a joint municipality or joint administration or internationalization of Jerusalem. I don't know. There are ideas, but if anyone thinks that you can reestablish the border inside Jerusalem, it's gone. Israel's even built a light train there on the former border between East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem. It's all gone. Forget it. You know what? I don't even think that a majority of Arabs in Jerusalem want the city divided. Despite everything. You know, people would, if you read an Australian paper, would say, Palestinians in Jerusalem claim Jerusalem the capital of Palestine. Then you go to Damascus Gate, and you can't find one Palestinian who wants to live under Fatah and Hamas.
I've got a question here. We're getting to the end. Yes?
Why do the Arab countries that are host to Palestinian refugees maintain them in camps?
And very harsh conditions. Why do Arab countries maintain the refugees in refugee camps? I wish they were really maintaining them. I mean, Assad 2 days ago was shelling a refugee camp in Syria. I didn't see the UN Security Council meet to condemn, you know, the shelling of a refugee camp. In 2007, the Lebanese army used heavy artillery to destroy 70% of a refugee camp called Nahr al-Barid, a Palestinian refugee camp. Until now, the refugee camp has not been rebuilt, and 40,000 people lost their homes. Again, I didn't see the UN Security Council meet. I mean, most people don't even know about the story. Why? Because, you know, it doesn't have an anti-Israel angle to it, so it's not a story for the West. In the Arab world, the treatment of Palestinians is as if they are fifth-class citizens. In Lebanon, you have a law that bans Palestinians from working in 52 professions. By the way, it's good news, because until 5 months ago, it was 72 professions. A Palestinian in Lebanon is not allowed to be a driver, a carpenter, a nurse, a doctor, and there's a long list. This is a law, a written law. Can you imagine if the Knesset met tonight and passed a law that says Khalid, the Arab Muslim citizen, cannot work in a Jewish paper? You know what? I'm sure President Obama would call to condemn him. But in the Arab world, as I said, Palestinians are treated like that. They are deprived of nationality. The Arabs don't give them even citizenship. You can live in Kuwait. My uncles, from my mother's side, they have been living in Kuwait for 35 years. And by law, they are banned from purchasing their own house in Kuwait, which is an Islamic country. In Kuwait, they are banned by law from sending their children to the same school as Kuwaiti nationals. I am their nephew, and I live in the Jewish state, where I bought a house in a Jewish neighborhood, and my daughter goes to a Jewish school. And my uncles in Kuwait envy me. So you're lucky, you know, you live under the Jews over there. You have rights.
We're right on 7 o'clock, so we've got just a final. I know you don't like looking forward more than 10 minutes, but what about 1 month? I mean, if you had to look at a scenario for the United Nations in September, I mean, this is a currently debate in Australia whether the Australian government should abstain or oppose this motion.
Look,
what do you think the issues there are?
If you believe, or if you think that the statehood bid is going to bring peace on September 20, then of course you should support it. But if you see that what Mahmoud Abbas is doing is causing more controversy and rivalry and tensions, then you need to go to Mahmoud Abbas and say, excuse me, sir, calm down, climb down the tree, wait for another time, go back and give them another chance. Don't fall into the trap. When everyone is warning you, don't do it. You can't damage your relations with the Americans and the Europeans. The Arab world doesn't care about you. The rest of the world does not care about you. The only people who are feeding you are the Americans and the Europeans who are giving you money. So go to, you know what? He will tell you, well, Israel does not want to give me. I will tell him, okay, you know, go negotiate for another 3 months. When Israel does not give you what you want, and Israel says, I am against a two-state solution, then we will find a way. But be careful with your moves. That should be the attitude of all those who want the good of the Palestinians. To advise the Palestinians to do the right thing and not to fall into a trap. I'm not against statehood. there should be a state, but I'm against the way he's doing it. It's going to cause more divisions among the Palestinians. And it's going to play into the hands of the enemies of peace.
Many thanks. Thank you. More questions, we always finish on 7 o'clock, and we're right on 7 o'clock. Well, it's been a terrific night tonight. I've learned a lot, but so in thanking our speaker, Khalid Abu Tameh, I should say, firstly, it was a very important account, and you're a very brave man.
Just a journalist.
And I think there's a lot to be said for being just the journalist, because you can say what you want to say, whereas all politicians, as we know, in democracies are restricted as to what they can say, but journalists can say what they want to say, and you've said it very powerfully tonight in a memorable address. We'll be delighted to publish it in our journal in time, and it'll be up on our podcast. But tonight, well done, and have fun in the rest of your time in Australia. And thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.